Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here, people. Just as a 600-point drop on the Dow isn't the end of the world, so too, a 600-point gain does not mean all is well. Tell you, though, sure is interesting, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 26th of August. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. There is really just one word you need to know to sum up today's session on Wall Street. And truth be told, much of the past week or so in the global economy to boot. That word is volatility. It's not like Wall Street hates volatility or anything. There is actually even a way to trade it. And we're going to talk in a minute to the man who invented the volatility index, the VIX it's called. But before we do that, a pause to point out this oh-so-salient fact. For decades now, when stock markets have gone haywire for one reason or another, markets and regulators have set up rules to keep that from happening again. So, given the spectacular, and here is that word again, volatility of the past couple of days, aren't we maybe due for a new set of rules? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
To see how crazy things got over the past few days, just take a look at GE's stock.
At one point, they had dropped 21% from the night before, and then they rapidly rebounded.
James Angel is associate professor at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. He says there are safeguards to keep volatility like this from happening. They're automatic circuit breakers.
If a stock moves too far too fast, it's their job to basically say, hey guys, time out. The price of this stock is about to do something haywire.
If a circuit is tripped, a stock or an entire stock market can take a 15-second breather or even a 15-minute breather. Ed Clissold is with Ned Davis Research.
The idea behind closing exchange for a period of time is allows cooler heads to prevail.
There are more than 1,300 of these circuit breakers tripped on Monday.
It's debatable just how effective they are.
Zachary Carabel heads global strategy at InvestNet. Different types of stocks have different triggers, and stocks like GE certainly didn't look like they were helped much.
Because these rules have been invoked constantly over the past 2 days, but it certainly hasn't prevented some pretty intense market movements. I suppose you could say those movements would have been even more intense and perhaps really destructively intense had it not been for these.
So do we need another set of reforms to cut volatility? Well, there comes a point where rules can be tweaked, but not much else, and markets will just be markets.
It's kind of like, they're designed to make sure the roads are clearly marked and there aren't huge potholes. They're not really designed to make sure that people drive well.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, back to volatility. There is listed on the Chicago Board Options Exchange a thing called the VIX that I mentioned a minute ago, the Market Volatility Index. It can be, as I said, and is traded. You can think of it as a measure, forgetting for a minute about the Dow and the rest of them, it's a measure of how freaked out we are. And it turns out we are more freaked out now than we have been in almost the past 7 years. Robert Whaley is a professor of finance at Vanderbilt University. He is also the guy who invented the VIX. Professor Whaley, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
We had you on the program about 4 years ago, the last time the VIX kind of went a little bit haywire. Here we are again in a week, 10-day period where things are interesting, we should say. Is this what you thought we would be doing with the VIX, looking at it and going, oh my goodness?
Initially, no, but I sure do now. There's some strange things going on, and I looked at it last week. Beginning of the week, it was about at a level of 12. At the end of the week, it was at 28. That's the biggest percentage increase that the VIX has ever had in its entire history.
The measurement right now is 34% plus or minus. What exactly is that a measurement of?
It's a measure of the volatility you expect over the next 30 days. And so volatility for the S&P 500 is typically, if you go back 50 years, around 20%. Hmm. And so if you're looking at a level of 34%, it is very high. But at the same time, you can flip it about.
Monday, arguably, the VIX broke, right? It didn't start trading for a half an hour and until half an hour after the opening bell because of some of the craziness that was out there. It seems like a flaw, yeah?
It was strange. It was very strange. But what happened was the spread between the bid and the ask was so large that it introduced a lot of noise into the VIX itself.
That's the offer to buy and sell, the bid and the ask.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
So there was too much volatility for the volatility index.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's not a reassuring realization.
Well, typically the market doesn't do that. What you have is a situation where you came in off the weekend. There were all sorts of chicken little reports over the weekend, and it created investor fear. And market makers have to react, have to trade at the open, and they need to widen their spreads in order to protect themselves if the market goes in one direction or another.
I've been saying all week that this is not 2008, right? That structurally there are a whole lot of different things going on. Does this remind you at all of 2008?
No. You have these geopolitical events and the market overreacts. The only event we have going on now, to my mind, is China. There wasn't a whole lot of news coming out last week about anything else that would cause the VIX to move. I think the market's simply overreacting to what's going on in China.
And now what happens, do you think? I mean, I'm not asking you to predict the future, but as the guy who invented the volatility index, I'm going to ask you to do a little crystal balling.
Okay, a little crystal balling. I think what you're going to see, things will get calmed down. Mm-hmm. There's just too much repeated information flow about one issue, and it just has tended to scare people, as is reflected in the higher level of VIX and portfolio insurance.
Bob Whaley is a professor of management at the Owen Graduate School of Management at Vanderbilt University. He is also the guy who invented the index of the day today. It's the VIX. Professor Whaley, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you for your time.
Not to bury the lead or anything, but it was a whiz-bang kind of day on Wall Street. You know, if you forget the past week or so. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been much hand-wringing the past 10 days or so about American companies that are betting a big chunk of their future growth on the growing Chinese middle class. One of the most vulnerable of such companies appears to be Apple, what with its manufacturing base there and all those Chinese consumers as well. In fact, CEO Tim Cook took the extraordinary step this week of publicly saying his company is going to be fine in China. Thank you very much. But as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, it is not quite that simple. It never is.
Apple and China are together, like together, together. The Chinese market accounted for about a quarter of Apple's revenue last quarter, and China is where the growth is. The Economist publishes something called the Sino-Dependency Index, a ranking of how dependent U.S. companies are on China, and Apple's at the top. Chris Christopher is from IHS.
On the surface, it looks like, oh, this might be bad. You know, this might be, you know, sales are going to drop.
But a Chinese stock market meltdown does not an Apple disaster make.
Some companies, you know, they're still going to do well. People are always willing to pay a premium for the Apple product.
It also helps that the near-term fortunes of the Chinese middle class aren't that closely tied to the fortunes of the markets.
In China, because people have high savings, they have a huge cushion.
Linda Lim teaches at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. She says the Chinese middle class also have jobs.
The consumption part of the Chinese economy should be relatively stable.
But China's economic slide could pinch Apple in other ways. Consider the devaluation of the Chinese yuan. Gene Munster is an analyst at Piper Jaffray.
When the sales in China get converted back to U.S. dollars, it has a negative impact on how much comes back to U.S. dollars.
Some of Apple's manufacturing contracts are agreed in dollars, which could also hurt the company's line. Apple could raise prices of the iPhone in China, but that might encourage Chinese smartphone buyers to look more closely at the competition. It's tricky. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Also on the list of industries and companies betting big on China, luxury goods. As Chinese incomes have been growing, American and European firms have been rushing in to sell to them handbags and shoes, jewelry, and more. Now, though, and yeah, you did see this coming, those same companies are getting worried as they see China's currency devalued and its markets crash. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York, which is a big destination for the Chinese rich enough to travel there and to buy.
This is 5th Avenue and 57th, a murderer's row of credit card shopping monsters. Tiffany, Louis Vuitton, Armani, and others are Venus flytraps for deep-pocketed shoppers. Bain data shows 70% of luxury purchases by Chinese happen abroad. So whether Chinese visitors spend is a big deal for luxury companies.
What are you shopping for?
Watches.
Really nice watches, too. I caught up with Jace Zhao and his parents coming out of the Rolex store. The family's not scaling back after China's economic troubles.
No, nothing changes.
$1,075.
Bill Kim shows off a sleek black Tumi case at his luggage store on 59th. Chinese visitors often buy the biggest, nicest ones he's got. Then they fill them up with goods bought around the corner on 5th.
The Chinese tourists who are already here are not too impacted by this change.
Sales staff at various luxury stores had the same take, for now at least. But many in China with luxury goods bought in New York never actually visit.
Right now I'm in front of the Coach store on 5th Ave.
Lucy Lee is the vital link in a particularly Chinese chain called Daigo. Many Chinese shoppers escape tariffs by getting others to buy goods overseas. Lee's customers have money, but not always enough to travel abroad.
I would say middle class.
Lately, her clients are asking different questions.
You do consider the depreciation of Chinese yuan, right? They will confirm that. So I think that will definitely hold them back.
If middle-class buyers dry up, that's a nasty warning sign for luxury companies.
Oh, I think it's huge.
Milken Institute Managing Director Perry Wong thinks weaker Chinese currency will hurt.
That really would cut down on the appetite to buy expensive products.
Wall Street is pouncing. A new analysis from financial information company Market shows a sharp rise in investors betting on luxury stocks to drop. What happens in China doesn't just not stay in China. It goes all the way to 5th Avenue and back again. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, people really don't care that much about what's going on in the stock market.
Really? I don't think that's actually true, man. And either way, we're still going to do the numbers. Oh, yeah, a little number we like to call the sad happy music. The Dow Industrials did regain 619 points today, about 3 9/10%, closed at 16,285. Listen real close, you can hear it, right? Sad and happy. NASDAQ up 4 1/4%, 191 points, finished at 4,697. The S&P 500 packed on 3 9/10%, 72 points, ended things at 1,940. Bargain hunters helped tech stocks make up some serious ground. Netflix pulled in 8.5%. Google clicked up close to 8%. Today, financials took it to the bank. Bank of America bumped up 5 1/4%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 5%. The VIX, by the way, closed, as Professor Whaley was saying, at 30%. He was talking about that percentage thing. That is down 15% from the day prior. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have talked more than a little bit on this program in the past couple of years about American wages and why they're so stuck. The Congressional Budget Office is out with some thoughts on that topic. Blame it, they say, on slack. Slack meaning extra workers in the labor market and folks who have given up looking for a job. Because it turns out that that number might be higher than we thought it was. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
These extra workers aren't officially counted as unemployed because they're not looking for work. They might be boomers who are pushed toward an unexpectedly early retirement, or millennials who decide to stay home with the kids. Chad Stone is chief economist at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
They'd like to be working, and if they really thought they could pick up the phone and get a job, they'd be back in the labor force. But we're not to that point yet.
So they stay home. Now the CBO says this pool of would-be workers is bigger than it thought, maybe because the severity of the recession made it really hard to get back into the workforce. Jonathan Rothwell is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The CBO seems to be acknowledging that
There's more slack than expected based on previous recessions, and so there's this unexplained slack.
The effect of this slack, though, is clear. Economists say it's one factor keeping wages down. Merrick Masters is a professor of business at Wayne State University. He says employers know there's this backbench of workers waiting for a job.
When they have a lot of folks to choose from, there's very little upward pressure on wages.
One bright spot in the CBO report, it says there's less stigma against the long-term unemployed because so many people lost their jobs during the Great Recession and found it hard to get new ones. The report says they could return to the workforce in coming years. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a big bet on solar energy that might be about to go sour. Homeowners in Nevada who put panels on their roofs and just like that created themselves many little power plants up there. Now the big power company in that state is pushing back. It's part of Berkshire Hathaway, which is Warren Buffett's empire. Regulators in the Silver State are set to make a big decision that could slow solar in its tracks. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Nevada regulators face several plans to change how solar panel owners are billed and credited. NV Energy, the big utility, wants to impose a new monthly fee for having solar.
Their proposal would eliminate all savings for solar customers.
Brian Miller is with Sunrun, a solar installation company that likes the system as it is.
That's the definition of eliminating the industry. So this debate's about one word, competition.
Electric companies in other states are also trying to impose new fees. Green groups say the Nevada fee could jack up bills by $70. It's called the demand charge.
Which is too complicated to explain, and anybody could read the 1,000-page filing and still not understand how much they would pay under this Byzantine set of charges and fees.
NV Energy side? Well, the company's Kevin Garrity says if you own solar today, you get so many credits that you hardly pay anything to the electric company, which still runs the grid that you use when there's no sun.
At any one time, if a cloud goes by or your system fails, NV Energy service to your home will assure that your lights don't dim, they don't flicker, and that demand charge represents just how much that you are depending on the grid for your energy choices at your home.
Is this about quashing competition? A power industry paper calls rooftop solar a disruptive challenge. Larry Riley is a former utility executive.
Well, I think utilities have been not stellar examples of players in competitive businesses.
He says power companies are making less money as solar grows. So one solution, charge every customer a lot more for simply connecting to the grid.
The analog there is the way cable TV is built. You pay a fixed amount to have cable TV, and if you never turn the TV on at all, you're still going to pay that charge per month.
Just last week, Nevada hit a state solar energy cap. Regulators can't lift that cap, but they can't allow new customers at new rates. Still, all this uncertainty has led one big solar company to abandon sunny Nevada. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Sometimes what you got to do when you really want to know what's going on, especially in volatile times like these, is just get out and walk around. Step away from the computer and the TV and see what people are actually talking about. That's what our China correspondent Rob Schmitz did today. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so you've been out walking around today talking to people. Who'd you talk to and what'd you find out?
Well, the first place I visited is across the street from the bureau. It's a Sichuan restaurant, and I like spicy food, so I am a regular there. The place has kind of a weird story. 6 months ago, there was another Sichuan restaurant in the same spot, but it was shut down because, this is going to sound a little weird, it was shut down after it was reportedly discovered that the staff was lacing the dishes with opium poppy seeds.
Okay, but why?
Well, it's this old trick that they do in Sichuan so that the customers sort of get hooked to the merchandise.
Nice, nice. Very good. All right. What did you find once you got some non-opium-laced people talking?
Okay, so in its place is a new restaurant that is basically the same thing. It's a carbon copy of the old one, same menu, same cooks. It's like sort of like a pirated restaurant, except it does not have the opium. So I spoke to one of the cooks. His name is Gao Bin, and I asked him how business was. So he told me that business is really good, that each day at noon there's a line of customers customers right out the door. You've got good prices there, you've got good service, you've got good food, but most importantly, you've got a growing economy. We've seen the headlines this week about China's market crash, mm-hmm. but what's missing here is some very important context. Despite the stock market, China's economy is continuing to grow at around 6 or 7%, faster than nearly every other economy in the world.
And that is growth that we here in the States would love to have.
Right.
All right. Who else is out there today when you were talking?
So around the corner from the Sichuan place is a row of fruit stands. Here you hear a shop owner selling mangoes, cantaloupe, you name it. So this guy's name is Wang Tao, and he's from Shandong province up north. He told me that business is better than it's ever been. And I asked him if he owns stocks.
No way. Where I'm from, people don't buy stocks. We don't understand it. We're not interested. And it doesn't seem stable.
Yeah, no kidding, doesn't seem stable. Come on, man.
So, you know, Wang's skepticism here of the stock market is pretty common. You know, less than 7% of urban Chinese actually own stocks. And that's a huge difference from the U.S., where around half of Americans own stocks. For us, stocks make up a lot of our household income, our retirement benefits. It's part of our lives. So when the stock market crashes in the U.S., we really feel the pain. But when China's market crashes, not a big deal for most Chinese. If you're Chinese and you have money, you usually invest it in property, sometimes wealth management products from a bank, or you just put it in the bank and deposit there. It's not typically in the stock market.
Did you meet anybody, though, who was in the market, Rob?
I did. I met one guy who claimed he owned stocks. He was shopping at Wang's fruit stand. His name is Qiu Zhongting. And he told me his wife bought some stocks a couple of years ago, but he really wasn't worried about those stocks.
Wait, he wasn't worried about the stocks?
No, he really wasn't worried about it. You know, number one, she put it in 2013 when it was actually still lower than it is now. But he also sort of called it, he said, he just basically called it play money. I mean, he was really more worried about the news this week that China's government was planning to invest part of the state pension fund into the stock market. You see, Cho is retired, and the only monthly salary that he gets is his $500 pension.
I'm scared. Us old people, we have to rely on our pensions. If they lose their value, we all suffer. People say China's economy will be good in the future, but those are just words. Who knows? A while ago, they told us the stock market would rise and keep on rising. In the end, it crashed.
And I think Cho's lack of trust in China's government and its financial system is pretty common, too. You know, people really don't care that much about what's going on in the stock market. But if the government starts putting their money into the stock market, that's when people will start to worry a little more.
Our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, back from a day walking around Xinjialu there in Shanghai where the bureau is. Rob, thanks very much.
Thanks, guy.
Context in times like these is important. So here with comedian Sam Weiner with what he thinks about how a lot of people have been talking about stocks lately.
When the market goes wild, people say the economy is like a roller coaster. And frankly, I am sick and tired of this disgusting comparison. Someone has got to stick up for the inventor of roller coasters, my grandfather, Dr. Johann T. Roller Coaster. You see, the economy is nothing like a roller coaster. When a roller coaster goes up, coaster fans know it's gonna go back down. But when the market goes up, money fans pretend it's gonna keep going up forever. The fact is, economic downturns are cyclical. But you don't hear the inventor of the wheel, Pete Wheel, getting slandered every time capitalism takes a nosedive. You know what else takes nosedives? Dolphins. But the discoverer of dolphins, Wesley Dolphin, doesn't have his family name dragged through the mud after every financial disaster. Besides, lots of things go up and down, not just roller coasters. Okay, I couldn't think of a better metaphor than roller coasters, but I do know two things. One, my grandfather, Dr. Roller Coaster, was the best man I've ever met. Or he would have been if he hadn't died in a roller coaster accident 40 years before I was born. And two, don't invest your money in roller coasters. The market for amusement rides has taken a real dolphin.
Sam Weiner is a comedian in New York City. He is also, it turns out, a staff writer at BuzzFeed. Final note on the way out today, a follow-up to the program from last Friday when I asked Cardiff Garcia and Lee Gallagher in our weekly wrap to guess in five words or less what Janet Yellen is thinking right about now. We got some answers from you on Facebook and on Twitter. Remember, five words or less, what is Janet Yellen thinking? Here's the tape.
Now for my next trick.
I don't have to say.
Give me a break.
That's just a couple of them. Those were all indeed five words exactly, unless you don't count our bleep, but that's the FCC's rule, not ours. In order, Grant Freeman, Meg Goldthwait, and Gary Levine. Keep sending them. Marketplace APM on Facebook, at Marketplace, if you want to tweet at us. So it bears repeating, I suppose. Take a deep breath, everybody, with stocks up and with stocks down, too. The Dow up 619 points today, 3.9%. The NASDAQ advanced 4.25%, about 191 points. The S&P 500 put on 3.9%, 72 points there. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and we are back tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.